Well, while we have trouble on our own border, it's not the only hot spot in the world. We're going to talk about a couple more right now with our next guest. He's on our KTSA Window World Newsmaker line. Jed Babin writes for American Spectator and is a former Deputy Undersecretary of Defense in the Bush 41 administration. And Jed Babin, hope you had a great Thanksgiving and good morning to you.
Well, good morning. I hope you had a great one, too. We sure did, and I'm trying to work it off right now doing my exercises.
I heard about that. I heard about the exercises. Well, good. Let me ask you first about Brexit and what's going on with British Prime Minister Theresa May. She has, I guess, obtained the approval of the EU and the various heads of government in the EU for this plan that the British people have already voted on. So what happens now?
Well, the point really is the British people voted on something very different than this. May's plan really keeps the EU as a supervisor and basically boss over all UK trade, and really has a lot of other restrictions on what the UK can and can't do. One of the big disputes that's still not resolved is over fishing rights, unilateral fishing rights the EU has in British waters. So there's an awful lot that's left to be done, and quite frankly, May's deal is a pretty lousy deal, Jack. So it's very likely at this point that it's going to go, well, it will go in front of the British Parliament, and it's, I'd say it's probably a 55-45 chance that it gets voted down.
And just so we're clear, the opposition to it is both from the so-called Remainers, meaning the people that want to stay in the EU, but right. also from people who were supporting Brexit, who are saying, as you are, hey, this isn't faithful to it.
Yeah, and it's really adding up to an awful lot more people who are likely to vote against it than May can stand. In fact, if it does go down, her government's probably going to fail right at that same point. So she's going to be out, and who knows who's going to be the next British Prime Minister. If the British end up with no deal, it's going to be bad for them for a short period of time, but we're going to come in with a new trade deal for them. A lot of other countries are as well. And quite frankly, in a very short time, they're going to recover, and it's going to be much better for them than what's going on now in May's deal.
So if she, if her political fortunes fall, who is likely to succeed her? Is it the end of her party's long rule or run? And if so, who next? And what does that mean for Brexit then?
Well, first off, I think it's going to mean the end of her run, and probably you'll see somebody like Boris Johnson, former mayor of London, mm-hmm. to become the next British Prime Minister. Jeremy Corbyn, the liberal lunatic who runs the Liberal Party, is not going to be elected Prime Minister because as bad and weak as May was, everybody's sitting back and saying, hokey smoke, Bullwinkle, we can't make this idiot Prime Minister. So you might end up with Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg, a couple of other names floating around out there, but it'll still be a Tory government, and it probably will be stronger than May's government. Well, frankly, that's a pretty low bar to jump over.
You know, she's a smart person. She obviously didn't get where she is without being one. How did she figure to negotiate a path between the Remainers and the Brexiters? How did she think it was going to work if neither of them were getting what they wanted?
Well, I think she had the idea that she was going to get a better deal, pardon me, from the EU. She thought that they would be more sympathetic. They are not. She thought that she'd be able to get a better deal than anybody else could. And quite frankly, she saw it as the only opportunity for her to become prime minister because she's not someone, I mean, she did vote for Remain herself, don't forget. So she was a Remainer, it still is. And she thought she could probably peddle it softly enough for the British people to go along with it. I don't think that's working for her. And quite frankly, the only reason she's still prime minister to this day is that nobody else wants the job while this mess is going on. She's the designated javelin catcher, and she's been stuck with that job because nobody like Boris Johnson wants it in these circumstances.
Talking with Jed Babin right now here on KTSA. At one time, it would have sounded very ominous to say an emergency UN Security Council meeting. I think those words have lost some of their portent in recent years, but there is one today over this seizure of naval vessels from Ukraine by Russia. What's going on here?
Well, the Sea of Azov between the Crimea and the Ukraine really is a disputed territory, a disputed seaway. And, of course, since Russia conquered the Crimea, they have been claiming extensive territorial waters off of it, probably farther than the international law allows. So you had the Mariupol port in Ukraine essentially barricaded by the Russian Navy, which is trying to take over, you know, that whole Sea of Azov. So at this point, you have a situation where this weekend you had three Ukrainian boats. One's a tugboat. I forget the other two. One's maybe a fishing boat. I don't think they're really Ukrainian Navy boats. One probably was. But they've been seized. They were fired upon and then seized by the Russian Navy. And now we've got the UN Security Council having an emergency meeting, which really is something to just sit back and watch and, you know, eat popcorn, because they never do anything. Jack, come on. The UN Security Council, how many resolutions did they pass against Saddam that he totally ignored?
Right.
I mean, it's just, it's not an effective body. And, you know, for that reason, we should give thanks.
So what is the U.S. Play here? I know the Trump administration has been warning the Russians about Ukraine and about their kind of what they've been doing economically to Ukraine. But what is the Trump administration, or what are their options now?
Not much. You know, we're not going to go to war with Russia over the Ukraine. We have been sending, I mean, thanks to Mr. Trump, we've increased supplies to the Ukrainian armed forces in terms of more than just blankets and food. We're now sending them anti-tank rockets and such like that. So I'm hopeful that we're going to continue that and maybe even up the ante there. But other than that, there's really not a heck of a lot we can do.
There was an interesting story I was reading in the Wall Street Journal last week about, the headline was Al-Qaeda bids for revival in Yemen. And Yemen is one of those places, again, we don't hear very much about, but there's a lot happening. And the article said that there are essentially people in Yemen who miss Al-Qaeda because there was stability or there was predictability, and there hasn't been since they left. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I saw that same story, and, you know, I have to believe that at least some of it is true, but I don't believe that there's any people, you know, any sane person who would look back at Al-Qaeda and say they bring stability and harmony into the nation. The real issue here is not Yemen. The real issue, of course, is Pakistan. Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is the number two, or what is the number one now in Al-Qaeda since 2006 when we killed bin Laden. He is probably hiding there. His daughter was recently arrested there and I think let go again. There's a big, big support for Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and a whole host of others coming out of the Pakistani government. And that's an abiding problem that we really haven't found a way to deal with just so far. And it's a very tough road to hoe because Pakistan is a very strong country. It's a nuclear armed country. So, you know, whatever's going on in Yemen is kind of a sideshow. And the Saudis are mostly responsible for the fact that they have failed in their war against the Houthi rebels there who are backed by Iran. Iran and Pakistan are the big players. And what's going on in Yemen, again, is really pretty much a side.
Kind of a proxy battlefield, I guess you would say. But something you and I have talked about before is that when you fight ISIS or Al-Qaeda at 30,000 feet with airstrikes, you don't often deal with what happens on the ground afterwards. In place after place, in time after time, we may have left behind a degraded ISIS or a degraded Al-Qaeda, but that creates its own new crop of problems, right?
Well, yes, but the real issue, and I think we've talked about this before, Jack, the issue is we are not defeating the enemy's ideology. We have not even tried. Radical Islam is an ideology as much as it's a religion, and we have not attacked it in any way, shape, manner, or form. They are conducting an ideological war against us every single day. And until we break their ideology, until we defeat that ideology, all the rest is just going to continue. We can be in Afghanistan for another year or another 100 years, and nothing's going to change unless and until we take on and defeat that ideology.
Yeah. Read him in the American Spectator and Jed Babin. Always appreciate having you on the show. Thank you today.
Thanks, pal.